Author, retreat leader, activist, and spiritual leader, Parker Palmer, is getting old. He wrote a book about it, On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old.
But I'm not a hopeless person at all, and I do feel that one of the things that feeds hope is a firm grip on reality. I have written and talked sometimes about my life as an activist, about the necessity of learning to stand and act in the tragic gap. And by the tragic gap, I mean this gap between the harsh realities we see around us and, on the other hand, what we know to be possible on the basis of our own experience. Not our wish dreams, but what we know to be possible.
Parker Palmer is next on Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Schuck.
You know, as a person who is looking his own mortality pretty much in the face, I think that when I take my last breath, I'm not going to be asking how effective was I at things that I knew I could never achieve, like eradicating injustice. But I think if I can say, to the best of my lights, within my own limitations and flaws, I was faithful to my own calling in that regard, I think I'll be able to check out with some sense of satisfaction.
My guest is Parker J. Palmer. He is the founder and senior partner emeritus of the Center for Courage and Renewal. That website is couragerenewal.org. He's a world-renowned writer, speaker, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community, leadership, spirituality, and social change. He's reached millions worldwide through his 9 books, including Let Your Life Speak, The Courage to Teach, A Hidden Wholeness, and Healing the Heart of Democracy. His 10th book is the book we're going to discuss today. It is called On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. He's with me via Skype from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome, Parker, to Progressive Spirit.
Hi, John. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You know, we were just talking just before our interview started that I'm a minister, and I've been a minister for about 26 years, about 57 now. And throughout my career, in every one of my 4 churches, I've been asked, told actually several times by people who were older than me, they would say, "Don't get old." And I know pastorally what that means is an invitation to talk about what's going on with them. But I found that to be a fascinating phrase. And I was thinking of that as I was reading your book, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old, the subtitle, that your book is kind of a response to that.
Yeah, it is. You know, as I say early on in the book, I regard myself as among the lucky ones to have gotten as old as I am, closing in on 80 at my next birthday. And of course, as we know, there are so many people in this country and around the world who don't have the privilege of walking that far in life. So I feel that it's a piece of good luck to reach a certain age. And as I say in the book, I actually enjoy being this age, out on the brink of everything.
So tell me about that title, On the Brink of Everything. I mean, that phrase is often used in a negative sense. So we're on the brink of climate collapse and civilizational, you know, and nuclear war and all of that kind of thing. But you take it from, what was it, an infant's point of view. You knew a child who had the brink of everything, 1.5 years old, and all of life is opened up.
Yeah, well, as you know, John, I write a regular column for Krista Tippett's On Being website, and one of my fellow columnists there is a wonderful woman about half my age named Courtney Martin. And one early morning, I found a column that she had done that particular week of a few years ago, where she was reflecting on watching her daughter, Maya, who was then, I believe, 18 months old, discovering the world with wide eyes and a sense of amazement. And early in that article, she used the phrase, "Maya is on the brink of everything." I loved the phrase, and given what had happened to me already early that morning, where there was a winter morning in Madison and the sun was just on the horizon making the trees glow, and the window out of which I was looking was kind of glazed with ice, so the red sunlight and that ice glaze made it look kind of like a rose window, and I stood there sort of gazing out upon this winter scene in awe. And it occurred to me that I, too, was on the brink of everything, just like 18-month-old Maya. And that phrase stuck with me. I actually wrote an article about it for On Being. And when it came to pulling this book together, I thought, that's the phrase I want to use for the title. Because for me, as we were suggesting earlier, on the brink of everything has a very positive meaning. I think of the brink as a place of perspective, metaphorically speaking, a high place from which one can look back, one can look around, and one can look ahead with new understanding, with new perspective. I've been especially struck by the fact that looking back, I can now see how the weave of my life has come together. Through a pretty unconventional career and a lot of what would look to the outside like zigging and zagging, there actually is a weave of some resilience, I think, and dark threads, problematic threads that I put into that weave earlier in my life that I later wished I could withdraw. Even they now appear as part of Everything Belongs, and I can see how they add to the resilience of the fabric. So I not only feel, you know, blessed and fortunate to be here, despite the health scares that come with age, and as I say in the book, I've become a person of interest to several kinds of medical specialists who used to be very bored by me. I'm no longer boring to them. But even with that, I feel the grace of old age and the perspective that it can bring.
There is an anxiety of growing old, and that is the loss of control of how things will work out. Think of health issues or thinking now in terms of medical science, of being able to keep people going long past, to put it euphemistically, their expiration date. And there's a great deal of fear and anxiety about that. Do you experience that too?
You know, I haven't, I mean, I won't say that I'm totally free of that. I'm still mobile. I still have as much of my right mind as I've ever had, which is a low bar, but it's still there. I think this whole business of control is something that I've been wrestling with as part of my own spiritual journey for many years. I came to understand many years ago that this notion that we are in control of our lives is really an illusion. And I'm a great believer in disillusionment. I have a section in the book about that. where I say, you know, people come to us and they say, I'm so disillusioned about this or that. And we look at them with empathy and we say, oh, I'm so sorry. How can I help? I think instead we ought to say, congratulations, disillusionment means you've lost another illusion and you're moving that much closer to reality. And since reality is where we live, welcome home. How can I help you lose another illusion? You know, hang out with me and I'm sure you will. I think that this notion that we are in control of much of anything is a very major illusion. And while I'm not saying we don't need to make good choices or we don't have to make good plans, we all know that life is what happens when we're planning something else, or that the thing we worry about today turns out not to be the thing we should have worried about. So I don't know quite how to explain it, except for the fact that I've been trying to lose the illusion that I'm in control of my life for a long time. But at this moment in my process of aging, I don't fear loss of control, because I think that assumption really faded for me quite a while ago.
Oh, well, I really like that idea that you wrote and what you wrote there about losing our illusions, that disillusionment is really a gift, as scary as reality can be. And I want to get back again to that on the brink of everything, because you have a viewpoint now, not only with your history of learning and teaching and writing, but you're at a point, and we are at a point in society in which suddenly at our fingertips is so much information, and yet at the same time, it's also very perilous, but yet we need the wisdom of all people, and in particular, we'll say the wisdom of those who have been graced to be on Earth for a good number of years, 8 decades, let's say, and we need that. Humanity needs that. The wisdom, the disillusionment, the waking up. So that we can find our soul again. That's what I'm finding in your book. I mean, you there are just so many beautiful quotes that I pulled out of there. Old is just another word for nothing left to lose, a time of life to take bigger risks on behalf of the common good.
Mm-hmm.
You want to reflect on that?
Well, that's a very rich force field, John, that you just opened up. And we could take that in so many directions, and I'd be delighted to do so. I was really glad that you used the phrase, we need the wisdom of all people. And because I think, as you know, I think that's absolutely true, and I know that you do too. I have a section in the book, as you know, on the importance of intergenerational relationships. Yeah. And I've been lucky in my work and in my life to be able to connect with a lot of people who are around half my age, and to really be in a learner seat with them. They have so much to teach me and most older people about a horizon that they can see a lot more clearly than I can as a person approaching 80. And yet that same horizon is coming at me, whether I know it or not. So I once said to a group of young people that I had gathered here at my home to learn more about social media and things that folks in my generation don't know much about, I said to them, you know, after listening to you talk for a day and a half here, I kind of feel like I'm standing somewhere down the curvature of the earth. You're standing much closer to the top of that curve, and you can see this horizon that's, in a way, I can't, but it is also coming at me. So I need you to tell me what you're seeing and tell me how you understand what it means, and talk about the best ways that you're finding to respond to it. And just as a laugh line, I threw in, and incidentally, you need to speak loudly and clearly so I can understand you. But they did in fact do that. And then of course, as part of that generative exchange, they asked me some similar questions about horizons I've seen and how I've dealt with them, because not every issue is new. Some of them are old issues taking new forms. I also think that your question opens up into some very important things that are going on in this society right now, things that trouble a great many of us, that have to do with a country that at least for some of us is in the process of losing its illusions about itself. I think it's more and more difficult to make a simple-minded claim that America is the greatest country on earth. Certainly, I'm glad to be an American. I'm grateful for my birthright citizenship in this place and for the opportunities that this society has given me. But we rank so low among the nations of the world on things like infant mortality, so high on things like incarceration, and of course, gun ownership and numbers of mass murders and non-mass murders, that it's really poverty rates, with a quarter of our kids, you know, going to school hungry every morning. The racism that was built into the DNA of this country from the very get-go by founders who were in many ways geniuses, but in other ways were bigoted. And it's a DNA that's very, very difficult to do genetic splicing on or gene therapy on, as I think we're learning more about every day. So it's a time of disillusionment in this country for many of us. And again, I think it's promising in the same way that individual disillusionment is, because until we get rid of some of the mythologies about ourselves, very few of us will be committed to working on the realities of what we're looking at here.
Yeah, I think the great illusion of being America as exceptional is hopefully starting to fade. I mean, it is, and the result of those kinds of illusions are really damaging, aren't they? I mean, all over the world, the military presence that we have everywhere, and the empire building, and all of that. And so, but the hope, I mean, I there are many people who I admire and I read, but it's really kind of like doom to the end. And I'm thinking it doesn't have to be that way. And there are ways of waking up that when just even a few people wake up and speak, bear witness to what is true, that things can change.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you mentioned that as well. Hope is a very important virtue for me in these times and at all times. And in fact, that starts with hope for myself, you know, hope that I can continue to be an engaged, creative citizen, a contributor to the common good until the very end of my life, and that I don't have to throw in the towel prematurely. Obviously, physical or mental disability may come along, and I would have to throw in the towel to some extent, but I don't have to get there before I get there. I don't have to get there because I have an attitude of hopelessness. And I think there are always things that one can do to engage the journey toward a better future. And as you suggested, it doesn't take lots and lots and lots of people to get there. I've seen studies in the last few years that show that something like 5% of the American population max was involved in the great civil rights movement of the mid-20th century. Well, that's, I think, called leaven in the loaf. You know, that's called the critical mass, and the critical mass doesn't have to be half the people or 80% of the people. It can be 5% of the people who created a movement that ultimately changed the lay and the law of the land. And we need such movements on a continuing basis. As we know, if you're a student of civil rights in this country, some of the most critical gains of the mid-20th century have been lost or have been set back. And so the movement is needed again and again. But I'm not a hopeless person at all, and I do feel that one of the things that feeds hope is a firm grip on reality. I have written and talked sometimes about my life as an activist about the necessity of learning to stand and act in the tragic gap. And by the tragic gap, I mean this gap between the harsh realities we see around us and, on the other hand, what we know to be possible on the basis of our own experience, not our wish dreams, but what we know to be possible. I think a classic example is we all know we're surrounded by greed and avarice and radical forms of economic inequity. But we have seen, I have seen in my own experience, radical forms of material sharing, which have put people on an equal playing field in particular situations, where those who have shared with those who don't have, and something new happens, a kind of a new form of abundance is generated by people who are willing to reach out to one another that way, to give and to take, and it goes back and forth. So we know that it's possible, and yet that gap will never close. The diversity gap will never close. If suddenly all white people in this country decided that black people were just fine and we could live together and we could have truly equal opportunity at school and in work, there's this need in the human psyche to have somebody beneath you on the ladder of worthiness. And so we'd find another group. We're finding another group to work that need out on. So it's if you want to be engaged in social change, you have to learn that these gaps will never close, but you still have to take one creative step after another in the gap to keep hope alive and to make incremental progress toward a future that you will never see. When I'm talking with audiences about this, I like to ask a very simple question. Think about one of your heroes in social change, or a hero who stood for love or truth or justice, famous or not, it doesn't matter. Just think about such a person. And now ask yourself, was that person able to die, or will that person be able to die, saying, I'm sure glad I took on that love, truth, or justice agenda, because now, as I'm dying, I can say everyone else in the world can check that one off of their to-do list forever. And, of course, the answer is no. No one has ever achieved that kind of ultimate effectiveness around anything that matters. As long as we cling to this notion that effectiveness is the measure of our lives, we're simply going to take on smaller and smaller tasks because they're the only ones you can be effective with. I think education is a good example. We're really no longer interested in educating children in this country. We're just interested in getting them to pass tests, which is an achievable task. Education is a lifelong enterprise that is never fully completed. And so just one final word on this. When the question arises, well, if effectiveness can't be the measure of our lives, although we can't abandon it, we have to concern ourselves about being effective, but what is the ultimate measure? And I think the word there is faithfulness. And by that, I mean very simply, faithful to my own gifts, faithful to the needs that are within my reach, and faithful to the ways in which my gifts might intersect with those needs. You know, as a person who is looking his own mortality pretty much in the face, I think that when I take my last breath, I'm not going to be asking how effective was I at things that I knew I could never achieve, like eradicating injustice. But I think if I can say, to the best of my lights, within my own limitations and flaws, I was faithful to my own calling in that regard, I think I'll be able to check out with some sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, that effectiveness is an illusion, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that because we can't know the effects, and we can't basically judge ourselves or others on those effects as much as we want, because they, you know, those are things that are we have to be detached from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we do, and you know, I think detachment is partly a spiritual discipline, but I think even more, it's just being in touch with the way things really are. It's being in touch with reality. I think we all have had the experience, I've certainly had it, of doing something. Let's say in my case, it's giving a speech to 500 people and feeling when it was all over that I'd done a poor job, that it had fallen flat, and that I wanted to be better prepared next time, even though I had worked hard to prepare this time. And then a year or two later, running into someone who says, you know, I was in the audience that night, and I just want you to know you really changed my understanding of what teaching is all about. And that's made a big difference for me and for my students, and I want to thank you for that. You know, we often don't know who or what we're serving. The best we can do is be faithful to the moment and do the best that we can in the moment. And again, I think it's an illusion. It's I think the Greeks called it hubris, or pride, to imagine that I'm making a huge difference every moment of my life. That's a nice aspiration. But if you seriously ask yourself, well, am I actually making a huge difference every moment of my life? I think you just have to quit whatever you're doing. That's not sustainable fuel for human action.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Parker Palmer. We're discussing his book, On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. More to come. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Parker Palmer about his book, On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. You write about, and you've had in the past, and you write, including in this book, about bouts of depression. It connected with me. I also have had those, medication coming in, coming out. But I want to gather that with what we're really talking about in this quest for reality. Obviously, depression is a complex thing. But how can we not be depressed if we're paying attention to the suffering of the world? Is depression, in a sense, in some way, a gift?
Yeah, it's as you know, John, and you've already said this in effect, having been there yourself, it's not a gift you'd ever want to give to another person.
No, absolutely.
Or a gift you'd want to receive again for yourself if you could avoid it. But as I wrote in my last book before this current one, I did a book called Healing the Heart of Democracy in 2011. And I said, you know, I'm prone to depression. It's in my family and it's in my own personal history. But I don't think all depression is a disease of that sort. I think some of it is like being the canary in the coal mine, who's sniffing the toxic gases before the miners do and keeling over in a way that warns others to get out. So, yes, I think there are things going on in our world today that it would be, things where craziness is not being depressed. Craziness is not being at least a little depressed by some of the things we see around us, by cruelty, by venality, by the total lack of compassion, by crudeness in how we talk about other people, dismissive, derogatory things that get said from high places. These are depressing things. They're also angering things, and we can maybe talk about anger a little later, because depression is often anger repressed. And, you know, one of the things that we all need to talk about, I think, is how much anger are we sitting on about this or that that leads to depression. But I think depression in the form that we're talking about it here, let's call it political or socioeconomic depression, the canary in the coal mine depression, sniffing what's toxic and trying to, you know, get a wake-up call about it. I think that's a sign of health. That's a sign that you're here as a real human being, and you're not trying to close your eyes to everything, close your ears, stop breathing the air, but you're experiencing what's out there, and you're responding to it. And then you need to learn to read those signs for what they are, and to find ways to keep them from taking you into a state of psychological, spiritual, political paralysis, which is, I think, where too many people are going, just throwing up their hands and saying, well, there's nothing I can do about all this. So, you know, I'll just hide out in my basement or cultivate my garden or whatever the sort of anesthetic of choice may be.
Yeah, and then the gift of aging might be, as you write, I'm quoting you, I've long thought that old age as a time when all that's left is to tell the truth, trying to remember to tell it in love. I love the phrase bearing witness, to what is true about life, about our own lives, about life itself, others, what's going on. People come to me, well, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Well, I don't know. Tell the truth.
Yeah. I think that's right. And you start with telling it to yourself.
Yes.
Because without that, you may be embarked on a fool's mission to tell other people truths that you haven't embodied for yourself. I mean, I try to, in the book, for example, this new book, I try to tell the truth about white privilege and white supremacy. I'm a white, an older, white, straight, privileged male. And it seems to me to be totally disingenuous for me to deny that either white privilege or white supremacy is part of what has gone on inside of me, and that its root system is still there. Almost impossible to avoid that when you grow up in a society and in a culture that privileges white people above everybody else, does so historically, structurally, sociologically. And so I critique the society, but I begin by critiquing myself, by owning my own white privilege, which seems to me to be pretty much a no-brainer. It's hard for me to name any of the most egregious things that the 45th president has done, and imagine Barack Obama doing them without ending his political career. Imagine Barack Obama saying, I could shoot a person on Fifth Avenue and still get elected, or saying what he has said about women and still have a political career. That's white privilege, that the current president can get away with that and actually, you know, gain a certain amount of fandom for it. And I say in the book that I think it's a real cop-out for white people to limit the concept of white supremacy to folks who wear hoods and burn crosses. which is a fairly small group in this society. But the seeds of white supremacy are within a lot of us white people. And in the book, I do my best to own up to that. So I think the capacity to speak the truth in love to the larger society, and sometimes that's tough love, but I think that capacity begins with telling yourself the truth about yourself and really trying to come to terms with your own flaws, your own fallibilities, your own shadow side in all of these things.
You mentioned earlier to talk about anger and being an angry Quaker, which is a marvelously jarring phrase.
Right, I have a chapter that I love slapping the title on there. What's an angry Quaker to do? I had a good time with that one. As some people know, Quaker, not everybody knows a lot about Quakerism, but I am a Quaker, and formal name of the religion is the Religious Society of Friends. And historically, we've been regarded as one of the peace churches, along with the Amish and the Mennonite, although our lifestyle is much more worldly and secular than theirs. And so for some people, an angry Quaker is a kind of oxymoron, that those words don't go together. But it's my belief that if there aren't things that make you angry in this world, you're somehow not fully tuned in to what it means to be human, because I don't know how one can not be angry about little children in cages down along the southern border of this country, separated from parents, in a system that is now having a very difficult time putting families back together, and in the meantime has probably caused permanent trauma with a lot of kids and with their parents. It's done a lot of harm, a lot of damage. It's inconceivable to me that any bureaucrat, no matter how bad, would create a system that would have those predictable effects, and yet it was done. And I'm angry about it. The question is not whether or not I should have anger. Of course I should, if I'm a human being, about this and about that. And the question is, can I understand anger as an energy that can be ridden toward creative outcomes rather than destructive outcomes? There's been a lot of anger in this country that has been translated into destruction. So let's elect somebody who basically swings a wrecking ball everywhere he goes to bring down a system that hasn't been working for any of us. And it's certainly true that the system that isn't working for any of us is a bipartisan issue. There's no question about that. It hasn't been working under a whole variety of administrations and ideologies. It's been owned and operated by big money for a long time. But when anger is translated into wrecking ball responses, it serves no one well. It, in fact, can destroy what has been carefully built up over many, many years by way of the protection of human rights, by way of the protection of the earth, and so forth and so on. So can anger be channeled? Well, we have historic examples that it can, channeled toward the good. I think the movements for nonviolent social change have been powerful historical examples of that. And a lot more has been accomplished through nonviolence than most people are aware of. There was a scholar at Harvard, he died not long ago, his name was Gene Sharp, who wrote a 3-volume history of the successes, about the successes of nonviolent movements for social, political, and economic change. Those books are not widely taught in college history courses. We're or even political science courses. We're taught about the efficacy of power, money, armaments, and so forth, but we're not taught about the power of nonviolence. So I do believe that anger can be channeled in positive directions. It takes a creative intelligence and a creative imagination and a fair amount of courage to do that, but it has been done, and anything you can find that has been done by human beings can be done again.
Speaking with Parker Palmer, if you're just joining us, On the Brink of Everything is his latest book, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. Carrie Newcomer has been a guest on my program for a couple of times. You're a longtime friend and colleague and singer-songwriter, Carrie Newcomer, and then that's the Growing Edge project.
Yeah, Carrie and I have been in conversation for about a decade about a whole lot of shared interests and concerns. She's a wonderful singer-songwriter, as you know. Writes all of her own music and now has her own music production company. It turns out that we have shared concerns about many things. We are both devotees of the writings of Howard Thurman, the great African-American theologian, who was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s guides, spiritual guides and companions. Martin Luther King Jr. was well known for carrying two books with him at all times. One was the Bible, and the other was a Howard Thurman book called Jesus and the Disinherited. We had a quote from Howard Thurman that we both loved, Carrie and I, and it's a quote about in which Thurman says, in times of death and darkness, look well to the growing edge. The growing edge is always the place where new life is emerging. He says at one point, the birth of a child, life's ultimate answer to darkness and death. We put up a website called The Growing Edge, which is inviting people to explore growing edges in their own personal, professional, and political lives. We're offering a series of growing edge retreats. First one will be in October. We're offering a growing edge question of the month, and each month we make a podcast about that question with Carrie and me in discussion with each other and sometimes with a guest. The URL is very simple. It's newcomerpalmer.com, newcomerpalmer.com.
I'm speaking with Parker Palmer. On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old is his latest book. We just have a couple of minutes left, but I really wanted to talk with you and give you a chance to share a little bit about your mentor, Thomas Merton. You said that you didn't meet him personally. You'd started reading his books after he died. But you said, without Merton's friendship and the hope it has given me over the past 45 years, I'm not sure I could have kept faith with my vocation, even as imperfectly as I have. That's a pretty powerful statement in regards to Thomas Merton. Can you talk just a little bit about what he has meant to you?
Well, thank you, John. I figured that he would be an important figure to you as well, knowing of some of our shared interests and paths in life. Yeah, so Merton, for those who don't know about Thomas Merton, he entered the monastery as a young man in search of meaning and purpose, went in, I think, at age 27 to a strict Trappist monastery in the hills of Kentucky, the Abbey of Gethsemane. And exactly 27 years later, he died of accidental electrocution after giving a talk to an international gathering of monks in Bangkok. He was a remarkable guy because, while he was a largely silent monk, he wrote a lot of books. He wrote 60 books in his lifetime. And then he kept layer upon layer of journals, which have subsequently emerged as books themselves. While his writing at first was very pious writing, it was the piety of the young convert to the contemplative life. He went so deep with contemplation that he started tuning in to underlying movements in this society that soon took him to prophetic writing about race and about war and peace. And so he became the kind of patron saint of these activist movements. And I think what he modeled for me more than anything else, John, was a remarkable way of bringing together the inner and the outer life. I think if there's one red thread running through my work over the years, 40 years of writing and 50, 60 years of conscious spiritual seeking, that red thread has been an understanding and a desire to understand more deeply that the inner life must issue in outward action and engagement, lest it sink into narcissism, and then that outward action and engagement can become a form of contemplation itself, of deeper knowing, which one brings back into one's inner life and starts to examine it more fully and more deeply. You know, Socrates famously said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And once I got old enough to amend Socrates, I added to that, "If you choose to live an unexamined life, please do not take a job that involves other people, because you're going to do a lot of damage." And I think we see the evidence of that all around us. So one way to name Merton's importance in my life and why I regard him as one of my most significant mentors and companions on the journey, even though I never met him in any other way except on the printed page, is this interweaving of the inner and outer life that was so remarkable. I mean, how a guy who spent most of his time tucked away in a strict Trappist monastery where they had a vow of silence, how he became a patron saint of the great movements around race and war and peace in the 50s and 60s is quite a lesson for a lot of us who want to live from the inside out and then from the outside back in.
Yeah, he was the inspiration, the spiritual leader for the Berrigan brothers as they were getting chased around the country by the FBI, said Matthew Fox. You know, recently I did an interview with a couple of guys, Hugh Turley and David Martin, who they've done quite investigation that Thomas Merton didn't die by an accident, as the popular story has been going, but he was actually very likely murdered. And this was a cover-up. And Matthew Fox, the theologian, often said he was suspicious of it too. Talked to CIA agents over the years, and finally concluded that there was a CIA agent who told him, we did it. And I think I'd be curious to see if you knew about that, if you were curious about that, because that makes a big difference to me on the 50th anniversary of his death, that he really died. It wasn't just some accident, but he died as a martyr for peace. And I'd be curious whatever you think about that book, The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, an investigation. Hugh Turley and David Martin put the pieces together on that. But
well, I've not read the book, although there has been that speculation, I know, from the very beginning in the late 60s when he died. No disrespect to anyone intended, and I'm sure there are people who have researched this more fully than I have. But I don't embrace the theory that he was murdered. For one thing, I don't think that he was a serious enough threat to the political order that the CIA would have gotten involved. He was certainly a threat to certain people within the religious community. From the day he started writing about war and peace and race, and he lost his pious audience, and his superiors in the Catholic Church wanted to shut him down. He had some very interesting ways of dancing around that. For example, for a while he didn't publish books on that topic, but he wrote copious letters to friends, who some of whom happened to be publishers, and they pulled his letters together and published them as what might have as well have been books, quite outside the strictures of the monastic order. So, you know, Merton was, he was not stupid. He knew how to get the message out one way or another. But I've known a number of people who were very close to Thomas Merton, including his personal secretary. And I'm quite certain that if they had believed that there was any credible evidence that he had been murdered, they would have been among the first to raise the alarm. As I say, I have not read the book you mentioned, and I don't know the people involved, so I mean no disrespect, but since you asked me my opinion, that's what it is.
All right. Well, there you go. We'll leave it there, but I invite you to check that out. And Alan, check out many of the things that you talked about with us today, including the Growing Edge website with you and Carrie Newcomer. That is about all the time we have, Parker Palmer. I really appreciate your work over the years and your insight into spirituality, and now your insight into aging with grace and gravity. Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old: On the Brink of Everything is the title of Parker Palmer's latest book. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you, John. It's been a delight. You're a great interviewer and conversationalist, and I wish you all the best.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit every week: WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee; WEHC, Emory, Virginia; WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina; Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania; KCEI, Taos, New Mexico; KACR, Alameda, California; WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin; KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon; KYAQ, Newport, Oregon; KZ88, Kabul, Missouri; KBOG, Bandon, Oregon; 3A Oldies, 91.9 in Epsom, New Hampshire; KFOI, Redding and Red Bluff, California; WEJP, Wheeling, West Virginia; and KPFT, Houston, Texas. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.